Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to another show of Open Government Radio. I'm your host, Steve Buckley, and today is June 1st, 2010. And if you're following along, whether you're listening live or listening later on, you can still follow along the discussion by going to my blog and following along with the links that we'll be talking about there. That would be ustransparency.com. And that's all one word, ustransparency.com. That would be for today's show, which is June 1st. And you'll see that the topic for today's show is Origins of Open Government. And even though I put 1990s there, that's just a reference. We will be talking about the history of what has led up to what a lot of people understand and recognize as the Open Government movement. I did want to... And as you can see there, there are ways for you to call into the show. If you scroll down, you'll see A, B, C. You can post a comment. It's kind of late for that now. But you can also email, and it's kind of late there too. But we will still have the call-in feature of the show, and there's the phone number for you to call in when we get to that part of the program, along with some of the links there, including the link that we'll be using the most would be link number 8, which is the link to the American Society for Quality's Government Division. And the reason that we'll be pointing to that is because the former head of the Government Division of the American Society for Quality is... our guest today, and his name is Bruce Waltuck, and he's a former federal employee as well, and I'll let him, there's some information that I've posted there about his background, but before we get into that, I just wanted to put a little thing there that says, newsflash, President Obama did not invent the principles of open government. I know a lot of people have, since President Obama has taken office and signed on his first day in office the Open Government Memorandum, which link number 1 on the blog there, that's the link to that one. But a lot of people hadn't heard of open government or they've been involved, caught up in it since then. Some people even before then had heard of government 2.0, which is another buzz term that had been around before President Obama came into office. But even before then, the idea of improving the communication between citizens and their government has gone on for many, many years. And if you want to go back far enough, it's gone on for many generations. But we won't go back that far today. I think we'll just be speaking with Bruce about the relatively recent past. At least it's relatively recent for those of us 50 and over. For those who are 30-ish, perhaps it might seem like ancient history, but we'll try not to go back too far. Give an idea that a lot of this stuff has gone on before, and certainly we want to learn from the past, and so we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. So, anyway, Bruce Waltuck has spent, I'm reading off here for people who aren't watching it on their screen, has spent more than 30 years as a leader in government quality and process improvement. He's worked 26 years for the U.S. Department of Labor, where he co-created and managed the Department of Labor's award-winning Employee Involvement and Quality Improvement System. Bruce is a member of the American Society for Quality, which I mentioned before. He hosts the division's webinars on successful government improvement, and you can learn more about the American Society for Quality Government Division at the link provided, which is I'll mention it here too, ASQ.org. That's the letter ASQ.org/GOV. Bruce is also a member of the Plexus Institute, and he holds a master's degree in complexity, chaos, and creativity. And he's written about government improvement throughout the U.S., Canada, Brazil, and Southeast Asia. And it goes on a little bit more there. I might as well rattle this off as long as we're here. It says, Bruce has been at the forefront of government improvement for more than 25 years, and I'll be talking with him about the history of work to improve government and the reasons why each generation of managers and leaders seems to forget what happened BT. BT meaning before them. Bruce will also talk about the ways to reconnect the body of existing knowledge on government improvement and the efforts of people at the government division of ASQ to spread knowledge about better government throughout the world. Anyway, and so let's turn to Bruce then. After that introduction, is there anything that we left out? Bruce, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Steve. Thank you for that great intro, and it makes it sound like I've been around forever, but as we get a little older, we gain, hopefully, an experience and knowledge, and I'm one of those people who likes to give that back and connect with others and share that knowledge, so I'm very, very happy to be with you today.
Okay. Well, perhaps to give perspective, I mean, the reason I invited you on the show is because I'd say in the early 1990s, I was working in an office of quality assurance, quality control, at one of the, it was actually at the Department of Energy. And somebody gave me a book on quality in organizations. And so not knowing that much about, or anything virtually about, I mean, I knew about internal oversight and compliance reviews. That's what I had been doing in the government up until then, making, you know, checking checkers. So I'd go out, check to make sure that people were following the procedures that they were supposed to be following. And so, and then my boss was checking to see if I was checking on those people and so forth. And somebody was checking on him to see if he was checking on me. So there was a lot of checking going on. And so I thought it was just, that's what I thought quality was, just a whole lot of checking. Somebody gave me a book on, I think it was probably on total quality management or something about total quality, which was a hot buzzword at that time, buzz phrase. And so anyway, after reading enough of it, it's at some point a little bulb went on in my head, and I realized that government did not have to be, was inherently inefficient. And so that was spoiled from then on, and anyway, was looking around at what other people were doing in the government, and I realized that this was not, I was not, of course, the only one who had figured this out, and that there were other, that this was the beginning of, you know, at that time, the internet was fairly new, or at least to many people, and the web wasn't even around at that time, just a twinkle in Tim Berners-Lee's eye. And so, but there were modems, and we were able to use different ways of communicating. And even though you and I did not connect at that time, there were, like I said, a fairly large community of people who like us, probably in their 30s, who got all excited about using technology to connect people and do better government and connect with the citizenry. And it's when I look at what's going on with open government now, it's like it's so much deja vu that it's scary. And so I look at these youngsters now, and it's like you want to, I guess, the natural parenting comes out again, where you don't want your kids to repeat your own mistakes. And now the dilemma is, how do you get conk your kids over the head to get them to listen to you so they don't do that? So,
no, I don't know if it's exactly that. I don't think we want to hit anybody over the head.
Well,
but
bigger,
let me add, I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
Yeah, go ahead. Figuratively speaking, I meant.
Well, right. Let me. Yeah. Let me provide a little bit of context, I think, on this. And the example that you gave about the checkers checking of the checkers is really a great example. And for many years, in both private industry and in government, that was pretty much the notion of what we meant by assuring quality. Well, there's a cost to that. All those checkers and all the time that they take and the samples that they need and the resources and money that they consume, it all has cost. And the basic desire or aim of why we want better government or open government, I think, has not changed. I think that that's the key constant that people need to reconnect with here. Well, whether we use the common phrase we hear now, better, faster, cheaper, or I like to think about it not only in those terms of costing less and taking less time, I think about the voice of the customer. Is it meeting the needs and expectations of the customers, our citizens and the stakeholders who we serve as public officials? And then finally, I add one more to that, not just better, faster, cheaper. I like to add happier, by which I mean those of our employees, our public employees who work these processes, those who used to be the checkers checking the checked of the checking, whatever. How do you feel as a federal or public employee at the end of the day? And can we, through this work of improving the processes, making things that work, doing things that work better, faster, cheaper, cost less, take less time, can the employee also be happier or more satisfied at the end of the day? Certainly the feds have the Human Capital Survey, and we measure commitment and engagement, and these are also big buzzwords, innovation. Another dimension of how we're supposed to grow in open government and government improvement. And again, the idea that there's not anything new in this. And the history of this stuff, certainly the modern history for those who have been in government for maybe 10 or 15 years, really begins in the 1980s with some one or two organizations at the federal level at least, notably the Norfolk Naval Shipyard, who began to adopt an early adopter and experiments with quality and quality circle participative management to improve these outcomes. Then President Reagan, again, those who are younger and have been in government service less time than perhaps we have, there was a Reagan-era executive order in 1987 that mandated productivity and quality improvements over the coming 5 years. That was the first serious look that many agencies, at least in the U.S. federal sector, were taking at what even meant, what was even meant by the quality of what they did. Like you, I worked in a federal regulatory environment. Organizations like OSHA or Wage and Hour at the Department of Labor, Mine Safety and Health, been in the news recently with the mine disaster. And when we think there about quality of what we do, we often have competing and different voices of the customers in government. Our business is not necessarily like the business of the private sector. Ken Miller, a writer and consultant that we know, wrote a book a couple years ago, We Don't Make Widgets, pointing out these differences. But again, the aim, the fundamental purpose is the same. Can we continuously keep learning, keep improving, so that our outcomes are better? And as you said in the intro, this notion that perhaps we in each generation of government managers and leaders for various reasons there is a tendency over time to forget about, disconnect from that body of knowledge and experience that came before us, before them, or, you know, whatever, before we were in the picture. So I hope that begins to set a little context for you and for your listeners.
Yeah, no, I it's amazing, and I don't know if you have kids, but parenting, okay, the parenting aspect, I don't know if you've heard this, you know, when you try to explain to your kids how, you know, you went through something earlier in your life, and you're trying to pass on the hard-fought, hard-won knowledge from that, you know, that one thing, and they look at you and say, yeah, Dad, well, that was then and this is now. Which is like, oh, yes, driving and drinking. It's so totally different now. Or, yeah, teenage sex. Yes, it's so totally different now. It's like, not. They would like to think so, because everybody, I understand it, likes to think that they are so unique. And just like We Don't Make Widgets, the book, I'm familiar with that. It's everybody, so many companies think, oh, yeah, well, all these rules might work for the rest of the world, but our company, you know, we don't make widgets here. We're
make special.
Widgets. We make widgets, and we're the only ones that make widgets. So we are so unique, and so everybody likes to think, including teenagers, that they're so unique. And all these other these maxims of life don't apply to them because, you know, just because they're them and so forth. So it's human nature. I understand that I was an ornery teenager at one time, or a know-it-all, you know, earlier in life. And I guess it's just a matter of the older you get, the more humble you get about what you don't know. And I'm sure there are things I don't know now that I don't appreciate, but at least I've trying to make myself stop being such a know-it-all and say, wait a minute, Steve, is that what you want to know? Or is that what you know you know? is that what you, the difference between thinking something and knowing something. And I think that's what some people refer to as profound knowledge.
Well, certainly that's what the late W. Edwards Deming absolutely talked about, profound knowledge. What can we really truly learn from studying the data and the behaviors of a system or process of work? And Deming certainly taught, and I would totally agree, that in order to really work on improving our processes to achieve those outcomes of less time, less cost, more satisfaction for all, you really have to dig down and do that profound knowledge thing. One of the precepts or principles that guided us that we put in place at the Department of Labor, and this was originally back in 1990, was that you didn't want to substitute perceived knowledge or the wisdom of your experience for what you could really learn about the existing process. Many times I've been at meetings, I'm sure you have and your listeners as well, when someone at the table will say, just let me fix it. I know all there is to know about this problem. I've been here, you know, 89 years or however long they've been there. And then when you really get the data, when you really get the facts, when you really look at what people are telling you who are working in the process or who are the customers of your service and products, you find out that the truth, the profound knowledge, is something very different than what those one or two voices at the table thought they knew. You know, there's a quote I love on this from Will Rogers. I forget the exact wording, but it's something like, it ain't what you don't know that gets you in trouble. It's what you know that just ain't so. And I think that's, those words are still a very wise guidance for us today.
Well, they were probably, I use that same phrase too. And I'm not sure because it might be Mark Twain. But
Mark Twain.
Yeah, they were both wise guys.
They're smart guys.
Wise, and I mean that in a good way, that they had this homespun knowledge, truisms about human and about large part about human nature. And I think that does speak the idea of human nature. We as animals, you know, you see the sun going across the sky, and so, well, of course, the sun is revolving around me. Of course.
And that's kind of a great segue to this notion of how each generation of government leaders seemingly plows the same ground over again, as if they were not connected, or that they have lost the connection to that continuity of both purpose. I mean, the purpose is the same, but certainly to the continuity of the body of knowledge and accumulated wisdom and experience of the leaders and managers who came before them. And some key reasons for that, I think, are pretty obvious. So whether we're talking about open government or government quality and improvement, we have a tendency as humans not to want to attribute success to the other guy, to those other people who may have preceded us, whether that's in the political arena and context. And I certainly saw that firsthand in the transition from the Reagan-Bush era to the Clinton-Gore era, when we moved from the quality movement in government to reinventing government, sort of similar thing, but different people, different players, different leaders. And again, in more recent years, as you know, you mentioned the Obama order on transparency and government and so on, and open government. Again, people who just saw that may not have noticed or have forgotten that literally just a year before the last presidential election, President Bush had put in place an executive order on federal government performance improvement, mandating the creation of performance officers or chief performance officers in each of the agencies that would serve on a presidential council, performance improvement council. This again was preceded, going back to the President's Council for Management Improvement, a preceding or predecessor organization back in the 1980s. So these things are not new. We tend to want to plow the same ground. We tend to want to discount knowledge or experience that came before us, particularly if it came from those who ideologically or politically or other reasons we may compete with or may oppose, if it's a business or a political context. And I think the key for us is to recognize and recall our purpose stays the same. Everyone wants better government. I don't know anyone that would get up and say, they may say, I want less government. But I don't know anyone that would get up and say, I want government that costs more, takes more time, delivers less quality of service and product. No, the constant purpose is the continuous improvement of government so that it does consume less resources and satisfies people and employees more. So then the challenge becomes, how do we reconnect? Where do we turn and what do we do to reconnect with the resources and the body of wisdom and knowledge and experience that's out there for us to have? And I think that's the next big thing. That's the next big question, you know.
And I will say to the listeners, I'm going to add these links because of the holiday weekend. I'll blame it on that. I was not able to put up as many links as I would have liked before the show. So I will be adding Bruce, I'm sure, can send me links to like the 1987. President Reagan, you said an executive order? Was that?
Yeah, that was a Reagan-era executive order.
Okay.
And there were
one.
Prime examples even before that, and then the golden age of quality improvement that followed it.
Okay, and then the Bush executive order you mentioned from the last year, I guess. Of
November
Bush.
Of 07. Something like that. November, December.
Okay.
I forget the exact date.
We'll track that down, and for the listeners, so that when they are listening to this later on, they can those links will magically appear for people listening later on or coming back later on to this to the website, to the blog posting. So, but I will ask. There was something I was going to ask on one of those. Well, I guess I should say that sometimes I bring up the reinventing government effort, of course. This would be between the 87 Reagan executive order and the Bush executive order, because it would be during the Clinton-Gore administration, meaning 92 to, or rather, I guess, technically, 93 to 01, where the reinventing government effort and their slogan was make government work better and cost less, which
exactly,
of course, exactly what you were talking about. Everybody, more bang for your buck, another way to put it. Now, nobody can argue with more bang for your buck. Nobody ever says, gee, I wish I got less worth for my money. You know, they take them away and put them in the funny farm or something if they say stuff like that. I don't even think those people would say it either. But in any event, more bang for your buck, these are the same things that the ultimate goal of open government is saying, yes, we want to, you know, it's not just to be transparent, just because we can all be friends on Facebook just for fun. The ultimate goal is to connect with each other so that we are better service providers to the citizens. And, of course, that would mean we waste less money which makes means we're more efficient and more bang for your buck, et cetera, et cetera. There is one thing I should point to. The president's first full day in office is when he signed the memorandum on presidential memorandum. It wasn't executive order, but presidential memorandum on transparency and open government. And if I do have that link there, that's link number one. But I'm not sure if you've had much time to, I wanted to point it to you, Bruce, if you could click on that link there, and we can all.
This is a link off of your blog or off
yep.
of.
If off you go of to if radio. You're at US if you're at ustransparency.com.
I am on that one right now.
Okay, and you go down to Handy Links.
Okay, let's find those Handy Links.
And then there's like 1 through 8.
Got it. Yeah.
Eight.
President's memo.
Number
got
one.
It right here. Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead and click on number one there.
And I have it.
Okay. Now, I'm not sure if you've read this through. It's only really about one.
I have read it, but not for a while. I haven't seen it.
Okay.
I've looked at it for a while, but yes, I have.
And so this got a lot of people really excited, of course, about open government and the possibilities and so forth and so on. But the thing that jumped out on me in my mind was when I looked, there's the three paragraphs there where it talks about government should be transparent, government should be participatory, and government should be collaborative. Those are the three
words off.
The three things that transparent, participatory, and collaborative. But in those three paragraphs, it says at the end of each paragraph, if you look at the last sentence in each paragraph, it says, for instance, under the transparent paragraph, it says, executive departments and agencies should also solicit public feedback to identify information of greatest use to the public. So, and then in the next one it says also, same thing again almost, or it says the same thing, that's input. That's funny they changed that though. Executive departments and agencies should also solicit public input on how they can increase and improve opportunities for public participation in government. And then the last one, solicit public feedback. So they went from feedback to input
feedback.
But I don't know if that was a typo or what, but I don't think there's much difference between those. I mean, there is a difference between input and feedback, but in any event, what they're saying there is that as you federal agencies are moving forward to be more transparent in what you do and be more participatory and to be more collaborative, at the same time that you're doing that, you shall also ask people how you shall ask them really for input, and they can participate on your public participation plans. So to me, that was like, wow.
And you know, Steve, this is a
thing.
Yeah, it's a great document. Particularly, I agree with you on this notion of partnering with the public, with the citizenry. And this has, to me, the very powerful implications for how we not just think about improving the processes and outcomes of government, but doing so in new and different ways. And to me, that's the particularly innovative or exciting dimension of this particular document and this thinking about open government. We've always had the opportunity as citizens to go to our legislators and provide that kind of feedback and input. But we're kind of mandating it here in a different way, on a much broader scale, I think. And here now with the recognition that technology today provides us with tools to do this on a scale and a level that we have not previously been able to achieve. And I don't know if you're familiar with the organization America Speaks as one example, but they conduct what they call 21st century town hall meetings. I was a facilitator at one they did recently for citizens in Prince George's County, Maryland, where the county government is envisioning the future of the county in 6 key outcome dimensions. They had 1,200 people in the room at one time for a workshop on this. On June 26th, at the federal level, America Speaks will be doing sessions with over 1,000 people each in 20 key American cities, plus dozens, if not hundreds more, of local events on the same day, all to discuss America's budget and deficit and economic future. So in one day, over 30,000 Americans will be engaged in participatory collaborative governance with great transparency. Technology has been the enabler of this on this kind of scale that we've never really been able to do before. And I think that being able to get this incredibly diverse and rich base of input from the voice of the customer, from the people who are in the process, on this scale at one time, building the consensus where the technology allows all to see the ideas and the emergent consensus instantly, as this is going on, as we're creating our future in that moment, will allow us to be that much better in the work of improving government performance and government outcome as we go forward. I think this is a great document for that.
And before I get, what was the date on the America Speaks?
That one is coming up on June 26th. And if anybody Googles, I forget the actual website link, but if you look for America Speaks, they are a nonpartisan nonprofit that has been doing this kind of stuff all over for a while. They call them 21st Century Town Hall Meetings. And having been a facilitator at one, I can tell you that the way they do what they do, with instant polling, with computers at every table, over 100 tables at the Maryland event, to where everyone can instantly see the ideas, and a panel of experts and key stakeholders who are vetting these ideas and helping to sort of collate them and sort them. Again, all in the moment, on the fly, to where, like I say, 1,200 people in the room can literally work together and at the end of the day walk out and say, here are our top three points for action, our agenda for action going forward in our county on these six most important things that affect our quality of life and governance. Very, very powerful methodology. So to me, that's just one story, one data point in this work towards a greater openness and transparency and participation and collaboration in government.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am familiar with America Speaks. Actually, it is americaspeaks.org, and I'll put that link up too. But that organization was, I'm not sure if you knew, but founded by Carolyn Lukensmeyer.
Yeah, I know Carolyn.
Was, as you probably know then, heavily involved in the Clinton-Gore reinventing government effort.
I do indeed. I was going to try and keep partisan stuff out of that.
Well, that's not partisan.
Just make it sound good.
It's just another example of people who got involved in quality and government efforts and saw that perhaps the greatest opportunity for improvement was the link with the customer, although Carolyn tells me she doesn't like to use the word customer, but I think it's appropriate that if you look up the definition of customer, people, you know, say, oh, citizens can't be customers because they're not paying money. Like, well, what are taxes? You know.
Well, again, we don't make widgets, and that's right. I mean,
people do
it's
get
the same way
that
people in government, when I began working on government quality and process improvement, I would have people say, well, you know, you're not like the public sector. You don't have shareholders, and you don't have market share. You're not like General Motors or Toyota or IBM. And I said, well, you know, we don't have them in the way that you think about them. But we have customers, citizens, and stakeholders who receive our products and services. And if they're not happy with the quality of what we do or the usefulness of what we do or the efficiency of what we do, they will go to the people who control our budget, our resources, our legislators, and our budgets will diminish and some of us will be put out of business. And that's our market share, and those are our shareholders, and that's our board of directors. And I think it's a lot more like a private sector in that way than we often tend to think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, people, yeah, whether you're paying for money now or paying for a service later, you know, the method of payment and the timing of payment has nothing to do with how satisfied you are with the hamburger that you're eating. You know,
right. We try to aim for all the above.
Yeah, it's a good hamburger. It's not a good hamburger, and when you pay for it, has you know, maybe for some people it tastes better if they're pooching off their friend, you know, like Wimpy or something. Maybe it tastes better like that.
No, but Steve, if you bought me a hamburger, it would taste better. I know that.
But you'd have to pay for it sooner or later.
Maybe.
But yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, the timing, people get caught up in because it doesn't fit their the narrow definition that they have about, you know, plunking your money down on the counter at the time you get the service, that type of thing. So, but really what it comes down to is the customer satisfaction. It's the person who you're trying to help satisfied with what you're doing for them. You know, whether it's a hamburger or, you know, fixing your muffler or you know, filing your taxes or government services, getting potholes fixed this way or the other. You know, as people, you know, if you fix the potholes, lickety split, get your roads plowed in the wintertime, then, you know, the method of payment. Really, they just want it done right and done the right way, you know, and hopefully in a way that is the least expensive that can possibly be done. So,
well, the potholes and snowplows are a couple of great examples. Our government division of ASQ hosted one of our occasional leadership dialogue workshops a couple years ago in Seattle, and we had a fellow from the city of Baltimore, and their CityStat system has gotten great recognition for improving performance and information data access and transparency to the public. And one of their metrics early on had to do with how long it took to, if someone called in a report for a pothole, how long did it take to get that fixed? And they could very proudly say that they had greatly reduced the cycle time, and that's all to the good. What my colleagues asked these folks from Baltimore was, what have you done to figure out why you're getting so many potholes? That's kind of the next iteration of that profound knowledge and avoiding the checkers checking the checked or the cost of the rework, what they call the cost of quality. Can we do it better now to avoid that kind of rework later? The town that I live in New Jersey has implemented a system where they have radio transponders in every snowplow. And if you want to know when your street is likely to be plowed, you can go on the internet to the town's website and literally see a map in real time of where every snowplow is. Now, that again, that doesn't tell us, do they have sufficient capacity? Do they have a process in place to dispatch these things in the most effective and efficient way? But it's a start. We're moving in the right direction, and the citizens are getting more access to information. Again, notion of transparency. By making it transparent, they're automatically increasing levels of participation and collaboration. Hopefully we'll get some better outcomes down the road.
And I'll just take a break here to for the people who are listening. This is Steve Buckley of Open Government Radio. I'm hosting today's show with guest Bruce Waltuck. If you want to follow along, it's ustransparency.com. That's the blog post that describes Bruce's background in the government as far as process improvement and how we're talking today about how it relates to the open government effort to make government more transparent, participatory, and collaborative with the idea of a better government in the end. And so I will take that, and just as you were speaking a little while ago, when I try to explain to people what they talk about transparent government, I mean, maybe taking a page from Mark Twain and the other guy, Rogers.
Will Rogers?
Will Rogers, right, okay, gotcha.
Whichever one it was, maybe they both said it, I don't know.
Yeah, Will Rogers, but the idea is that instead of slipping into government jargon and buzzwords, is that basically it's this. People want to know what's going on. So, you know, if you want to explain it to somebody, it's like, well, here we are in government and all this talk about open government. If the people out there have a better idea about, quote-unquote, what's going on, can, they want to know, if you can answer that, the better you can answer that question for them, give them a better idea of what's going on, then that's basically another way of explaining what transparency is about. Because the more that people
know, and I would turn that around too, Steve. I would not only can we tell them, but can we listen to them as well? Both, I think.
As well, yeah. To figure out, because the more they know, and probably we know more about them than they know about us. But the idea is that the more that both sides, the customers and the providers, can find out about what the other person needs. What the other person's providing, you're using the snowplow one. Even if you're in your house in New Jersey and you're snowbound, and you're watching where the snow trucks are, it doesn't get them there any quicker, right? You were saying.
No, I particularly pay attention to when they've stopped for 20 minutes at Dunkin' Donuts. I can see that on the map.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but at least you have a sense of what's going on. You're looking at your computer screen, and you can go, because otherwise, you know, you're sitting in a snowbound house. I mean, people have done this, hopefully, but people know, you know, you're sitting, and it's like the snow plow could be coming by in 10 minutes or 10 hours. And
right.
So you're trying to figure out, well, you know, can I plan to go out and get some milk? And you can't even plan that, because if you don't know what's going on with the snow plows, then you can't plan anything as far as, you know, getting out of the house and doing, you know, getting food or planning your whole day. But once you know, like, oh, okay, well, they're working their way here. I can see from looking on that. Now at least I can see where they are, and I can plan, you know, they'll be here in about an hour or two or something like that. Then you're immediately better, less frustrated than you were before you pulled them up on the screen. And even though you have nothing's changed, just knowing what's going on lowers your blood pressure and your understanding, okay, I can see they're making progress, they'll be here. And it's kind of like, you know, when your auto mechanic explains to you what's going on with your car, you know, you're like,
I think we could do an hour talk just about customer service and the point you just hit on, which is that every customer brings their expectations of service to the transaction, and then they compare that to their actual experience. And, of course, the goal of the service provider is to close and narrow and have ultimately no gap between expectation and experience, and maybe even surpass that, this notion of customer delight. Can we exceed expectations? And I'm sure we could spend a lot of time just talking about that.
But what you don't want to do is under-promise and over... No, is it?
It is under-promise and over-deliver,
Yeah, under-promise and over-deliver. And the opposite would be over-promise and under-deliver, which is no. Then you'll have very unhappy customers. Because
or make no promise and deliver and tell them to take what they get. That doesn't work very well either. But
the idea is that if you lead them to believe and have expectations that are too high, and you don't meet those expectations,
exactly,
then yes, they will be looking for new service providers, and that's probably what a lot of the frustration is with what's going on. I think, in general, with if you've seen any of the Pew surveys on trust in government and so forth, there's a frustration that people are not being listened to.
Yeah.
And certainly now that we're all, every single person, but compared to 20 years ago, I was waiting for the day, oh, yes, when we all get on the Internet, So now that we're all on the Internet, but people still aren't being listened to, now it's a matter of aligning, the expectations that people say, hey, I've got Internet access, I've got email, I've got this, and I've got that, and still the politicians in Washington are blowing me off.
Well, you know, that's right. And with or without the Internet, I think you mentioned a minute ago about how we communicate on this stuff. And some of your listeners will remember, others may not recall. There was a very well-known mayor of New York some decades ago, Ed Koch, who very famously would literally walk the streets of the city and go up to just, you know, the average person on the street, and was famous for his phrase, "How am I doing?" And that was his way of gathering that data from the people who mattered most, the people he was there to serve. And day after day, he had a sense of expectations. and where people were complaining or had problems or had issues, that could immediately be channeled back for some feedback, some research, and when needed, some action. And that kind of gets me back to where we started about reconnecting with these notions of government process improvement. You were saying before, and I agree, that this stuff isn't rocket science. The notion of whether we call it quality improvement, or there's a large trend now in government to lean thinking, lean production systems, derives from the Toyota production system. The U.S. Defense Department is doing the largest Lean Six Sigma Lean Improvement Initiative, I think, in the world ever. And the fundamentals of all of these methodologies, these are tools, but the basics are about as simple as Ed Koch's solicitation of customer feedback. How am I doing? It's where are we now? Where do we want to be? What are our promising options to get there? How will we know that something we tried took us in the direction we wanted to go? And once we're headed in the direction we want to go, how can we keep that result going over time? That's the basics of all quality or process improvement. That's it. And everything else is methodology, whether it's Six Sigma or Lean or TQM or XYZ. And so the question for today's government managers and leaders, those who have done this before, those who are new to this work, is how can we come together around the table, the younger and the older, the less experienced and the more experienced, and connect to this body of knowledge, wisdom, experience, those who are achieving success, and learn from the best of the best so that we too can achieve these kind of successful results. And Steve, can I take a minute and talk about what we're doing in the government division about this?
Yeah. I just wanted to make sure that I just wanted to interject one aspect, just what you were saying right there about customer feedback.
Sure.
The thing when the light bulb went on in my head, I mean, up until 1990, I was 36. Yeah. So up until that time, you know, I thought that quality, when I heard the word quality, excuse me, I thought it meant like, you know, Mercedes-Benz, Rolls-Royce, Cadillac, you know, I mean, high-end, expensive things. So whenever, you know, oh, that's a quality of this, and people do use it in that sense. But when I was started delving into it, I understood that what people were, when people were using that term in the quality management movement or whatever, or, you know, what is a well-run organization do, and it all came back to the customer, because if your customers didn't like what you were doing, then it didn't matter how much, you know, what kind of product you were putting out, whether you thought it was Cadillac or a Mercedes-Benz or, you know, the best car or watch or product that money could buy, because if nobody was buying it, it wasn't worth it to them. You were not meeting. You can have a quality product, and it could be McDonald's. Doesn't mean it's gourmet. It just means that people say, this is what satisfies me. I want a quick meal at this price, and this is what I. And so the quality and the customer decides whether or not you're doing a good job. So all this talk about when all is said and done and all the dust settles and everything else, doesn't matter what you think you're doing, whether you think you're doing a good job for them, it's whether they do. And the only way to do that is to either, walk around New York City, you know, anecdotally getting information that way, or doing surveys and, you know, the voice of the customer. And that, and there is a methodology for doing that. So in that sense, it was true back then. It was true. It's true now. The whole idea is the voice of the customer, getting attuned to them, because otherwise you're just, you know, wishful thinking about what you're doing. So anyway, that is the key thing. If I was to pass to anybody else about what the common thread through all of this, customer satisfaction.
So. Yeah, great point. I mean, we're talking here about government. We are public servants, and we must ever be mindful that while we often have competing groups of stakeholders or customers or whatever you want to call them, sometimes the interests of political leaders or business leaders may seem to be or may be at odds with the interest of another citizen group or constituency. If you're a mine safety and health inspector, that disaster that's been in the news lately, and you're doing an inspection, you have customers who are the employees in that mine whose safety is paramount. But you're also there to try and increase the compliance, voluntary compliance, on the part of the mine owner-operator. Those two groups and constituencies may not see the very same thing in the very same way. Government has some unique challenges in the voice of the customer, but it's not an impossible task either, and it's certainly job one. I agree with you, Steve.
Yeah. So anyway, but that, I just wanted, if people want to say, oh, well, reinventing government was about something else. No, customer satisfaction, just like this, because, you know, we could be all transparent and collaborative and participatory, and if the people aren't satisfied with what we're doing, then we're just legends in our own mind, so to speak.
But we don't want to be that. We'd like to be legends in somebody else's mind.
Yeah, well, and as, you know, having worked for 25 years in D.C. and you worked for the Department of Labor for 26 years.
Yeah, and most recently spent the last 2 years with, most of the last 2 years with HHS.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So, plenty of time in government.
So it's not surprising to you and me, and I think the president even mentioned this, you know, the idea that we in government, and I'm not in government anymore, but when you're in government, it's very easy to slip into the, well, you know, we're the experts. Just like you were saying before, I've been doing this for a long time, so I'll take care of it type of thing, because, you know, that type of thing. Whereas rather than involve everyone in the decision-making process, you're wanting to ride in as the white knight and slay the dragon because these other people don't know how to do what they're doing, you know, and I'm a knight, so that's what I got hired for. So there's this natural tendency, of course, to do it that way. And now the hard part is inviting, you know, the peasants to figure out how to fight dragons as well, or, you know, working together and so forth and so on, and preventing dragons from even showing up.
There we go.
Like, and so
that would be the deal.
Because if you're a knight and you're used to slaying the dragons, maybe you're a lousy manager.
I like to think we can put the dragon's flaming breath to use, toasting marshmallows and hot dogs for kids or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
That might be
a better
use of that liberated resource.
But you know, the mindset from Washington, when you're in Washington and you have all these large monuments and, you know, resources and all kinds of, you know, it's very easy to think of yourself as being on Mount Olympus throwing thunderbolts, you know, changing the world, and, you know, all this is happening. So it's the humility that is required to ask, like I said, the peasants there. This is more than technology. It's basically we're asking people to act against their nature, especially if you've been operating that way in your career as a federal employee, for instance, in Washington, for years and years and years. And so they all of a sudden say, okay, now we're going to try something different. And so is it any wonder that the people who have done so well operating under certain rules, you're asking them to, you know, turn the tables almost on them. And so I try to tell people, you know, there's no killer app out there that's going to make that person your friend, your real friend.
Well, it isn't quite that simple. I will tell you, and I would like to take just a couple minutes to talk about the work that my colleagues and I are doing to gather the harvest of success. You know, when I was at a conference just last week, a world conference on quality improvement in St. Louis, most of the attendees are not from the public sector. They are from all over the world in industry. And when people would come up to our government division booth, they would look at the signage about government and quality and improvement and performance. And I would ask them and say, when you think about where to turn for best case examples, for best practices in quality or business process improvement, how many of you think about government? Or that government comes to your mind, maybe not first, but maybe second or third? And, of course, the answer is virtually no one. But that's not the reality. Again, the profound knowledge of what's out there. We know that there are many, many hundreds, in fact, of case studies and examples of government at all levels of government all over the world that are achieving performance excellence and sustaining it over time. And so one of the tasks that we've taken on in the government, it's part of what we're calling our Moonshot Initiative. You know, Kennedy, President Kennedy, when he challenged the nation to get to the moon, said, we're not going to do this because it's easy. We're going to do it because it's hard and it's important. But we believe that the work of advocating and engaging people around the world to raise awareness, raise practice and results and learning about the ability to improve government, open government, process improvement and better results in government, more satisfied customers and employees in government. There are success stories all over the world, and so we've undertaken this harvest of success within our broad Moonshot Initiative, this notion of increasing the awareness and the practice of government performance improvement worldwide at all levels. We have now over 100 examples of great government improvement at all levels in the U.S., our webinar series, State of Maine, State of Georgia, Iowa, all doing lean implementations with great success, City of Fort Wayne, Indiana, and others. We did one a couple weeks ago with Erie County, New York, a phenomenal, phenomenal implementation of lean for business process improvements and results to their citizens. I didn't know until I was on the phone with the folks up there. The city of Buffalo is the third poorest metropolitan area in the nation. They have unique challenges, and yet they are meeting those challenges, doing things better, faster, cheaper, more satisfaction, with very difficult resource challenges, and doing it for a very low economic base constituency. So these stories are there, the opportunity is there. And I would encourage anyone who's interested in the work of improving government, we and my colleagues and I in the government division want very much to be, and we are, a resource to everyone and anyone who's interested in this work. One of the great advantages we have is that global network. We met just last week with delegations both from Brazil and from China, government officials that we know and work with, and this is the kind of network and reach that we have. We're happy to share that kind of resource. So I want to make sure, Steve, that your listeners know that we're out there to help them in any way that we can and support what they have to do in their own work. So thanks for giving me a chance to share that.
Okay. Well, I will say we only have a few more minutes here, so I wanted to make sure that people knew that this is not going to be the last we'll hear on this topic if I have anything to say about it. And I'm sure you have a few minor things probably that you'd like to add, but that we have to cover at another time.
Happy to come back and be with you and your guests again.
Okay. Well, and a little more, I'm going to make a little more heads up. Like I say, we won't do it over a holiday weekend then. But in the meantime, though, if people want to go to that link for ASQ that we have there and on the blog, talking about the government division you were just talking of, they can find more information there, and but I'm not sure how they can contact you.
Oh, well, people can reach me at my email address, which is the letter I, the letter M like Mary, the number 4, the letter X like X-ray, L like Larry, N like Nancy, S like Sam. If you read it aloud, it's I'm for excellence, I'm4XLNS@hotmail.com. And I'm happy to answer any and all inquiries. So people can find me. You can find me Facebook and Twitter.
Okay. And I'll put all that information down afterwards. I'll get that information later.
Thank you.
But the lady's telling me that we're ready. We're getting ready to sign off. So thanks again, Bruce, for being on the show. This is Steve Buckley for Open Government Radio on June 1st, 2010. And we've been talking about the history of the open government movement and its reiterations throughout the years. And we'll have you on again. And thanks for listening. And we'll see you next week, Tuesday at 2 o'clock.
Steve, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Okay. Talk to you later. Bye.